Welcome to the Dope Black Woman podcast, the podcast where we share stories of Black excellence as part of our safe digital sisterhood. I'm Leanne Levos.
I'm Rashan. You can call me Shan.
I'm Livs.
On today's podcast, we're speaking with Raifa Rafiq. Hey, ladies. How's it going?
Hey, we back for another week.
No, second week back in. I'm really excited. And we have an amazing guest with us today. We have Raifa Rafiq. Hey, Raifa.
Hey, ladies. Oh, it's so nice to be here. I'm really excited.
Hey.
Yeah, it's always nice to get together with women and just like have a nice girly chat. So thanks for joining us.
No worries. I'm happy to be here. I was literally just in that Clubhouse for like half an hour. I was like, oh wait, I have something to do.
I'm not on Clubhouse. I'm so out of the loop. Like, is it worth getting? Is it worth jumping on the hype?
You know what? There you can find, like, depending on who you follow, it so basically it's all about who you really follow. So you need to curate your following so you don't get the bad conversations that happen.
Yeah.
There are bad conversations.
Otherwise you'll be stuck in a room debating about colorism and black women and defending yourself for like
this is what I'm saying. 6 days. The clubhouses I've seen have been the same old shit that gets discussed on Twitter every 3 weeks. So
yeah,
I'm just
but
like,
you can find your own rooms and it's sick. Like I was in a room the other day with like Neo and like Pleasure P.
Neo,
and
Neo,
of them. Yeah, like all the artists. I was in a room with them and they were talking about like relationships. They were having a conversation about relationships. All my R&B sensations, and I was like, when on earth would I ever get to hear this conversation? So like an example like that is where it's really interesting. You can kind of geek out at like your fans and stuff. But a lot of the conversations you do see, all that I have seen have been like the higgity haggada of that you see on Twitter.
I actually haven't used it. I'm on it, but I never go into any rooms. Like I haven't actually explored it yet. So
I'm actually having a talk on Saturday with a friend of mine about therapy.
Oh my gosh, can we join?
We love therapy.
We do.
I had therapy today, my first therapy session of the year. So I was like, geez. You know what? This conversation is important.
No, I'm actually crying. How could you say it's about therapy? And I'm like, yes, can we join? This is all we talk about. Every episode, we shout trauma. Like, it will somehow naturally come out. We're so pro-therapy on this podcast. So that's really interesting.
We just talked about it in the last episode. It's so funny. We will definitely be joining Clubhouse.
Yes, we'll be there. What can I ask, like, how long have you been doing therapy? And like, as a black Muslim woman, how have you found it?
So I started doing therapy 2018. So it's been like nearly two and a bit years. How have I found it? In the beginning, it was hard. And this is why people don't talk about therapy. They think that going to therapy is like you just sit there on the couch talking about your feelings. But it is brutal, especially when you have to face up to some things in your past, in your childhood, or even just like yourself, like just looking at the mirror and be like, oh, so this is who I am? I don't like I don't like these parts of my personality that is destructive to me and maybe my loved ones. Yeah. So I think it's literally like the thing that has definitely changed my life. And I'm just a much more well-rounded woman, a much more compassionate woman to myself and my friends and family. But it was not easy. Yeah, it wasn't easy, but it's been so rewarding and I love it.
As a Muslim woman, what is the attitude towards therapy? Because I know as a Christian, I've never had this experience, thankfully, but I know there's a lot of people who, when they talk to their relatives about things they're going through or trauma-related stuff, they'll be like, go to God. And never like seek Absolutely. Help from a professional. Is that the same sort of challenges that you find as a Muslim woman?
So the first time I spoke to my mum about therapy, she was so worried because she thought I was crazy. Like she was like, what's depression? Like she's a smart woman. Like she's a smart woman. So she was so confused. She was like, you're going to therapy because you're depressed? Like just pray, you know, do all of these like, you know, maybe her big one is because you're not married. Like if you were married, you won't have these problems. And I'm like, yo, like listen, no. And she really thought like there was like, I don't know, I was either like, I don't know, schizophrenic or I had really like issues that she thought required more so like clinical
medication and stuff
and all of that stuff. Like she thought I was going to, you know, be sectioned or something. And well,
she took it to an extreme because that's probably the only time she's seen it represented.
And I'm from Zanzibar, and like I think there's probably like one psychotherapist on that whole island, to be very honest with you.
That is crazy.
It's not a thing that people do. A lot of the times, if you're having some sort of psychosis, you either go to the hospital and they tell you that, you know, you're just a little under the weather. They'll take you to, you know, the mosque, and you'll be prayed for by a sheikh or something. It all goes to hell. You're going to a village and they'll just do their magic there. So it's not really a thing that people do. But to be honest, I actually should talk to my parents and family more about it, but I don't, because every time I do say, I've got therapy, I just see my mother's eyes like,
So there's no convincing them to like join and participate in the process either.
I don't think so. I've tried. I've told my aunt once, I was like, oh, you know, have you tried therapy? And she's one, I think there's not a lot of access to it, because getting an East African woman to go to talk to somebody else about her feelings, like I can't imagine the pressure, but also the feeling of like failure, because these women are so much used to just like having their ish together and keeping their families going, that to have those vulnerable moments, I think, might just be a bit hard.
You know, we've spoken on the podcast a lot about whether it's worth or how important it is to seek out a Black woman as a therapist. And I'm wondering, did you have a similar experience? And I can imagine it must have been even harder seeking out, if this was the case, a Black Muslim female therapist. Is that something you wanted?
So at the beginning, my first two therapists were white women. And I only just started going,
oh, child, they get out.
They were white women. And I definitely had to spend a lot of time in the beginning explaining. So I had to do a lot of explaining and setting the context and stuff. But weirdly enough, right, and I don't know if you guys will agree, but weirdly enough, I had a bit of fear getting or thinking of getting a Black woman therapist, because there's one thing telling strangers that, oh, girl, I don't have it together. But there's another thing telling a fellow Black woman like, oh, sis, I don't have it together.
It's airing you dirty laundry almost to your community.
Right. And I had that fear, and it's still something that I'm like, you know what, I just need to get over it. But the thought of even getting a Black Muslim woman, then in my head I'm like, okay, but what level of haram are you? Like, are you a bad girl?
She's like, but can I tell her, listen to music? Do you listen to music?
I'm like, yo, like, I'm done. If I tell you I'm doing all of these bad babe stuff, like, what are you going to think of me? Do you know my mother somehow? White women, it's horrible. It's the ghetto. Sometimes can be a little bit safer. And I feel so bad, like, admitting that.
Can I just say, yeah, that I had a white therapist and she was not horrible or the ghetto. So, Liv, take that back. Thank you.
I'm sorry to white women everywhere.
You know what? So my first therapist, like, her name was Anne. Oh, my God. This babe, like, she read me to filth. And a part of me was like, this is racist. However, I see what you're doing. But, that woman saved me a little bit. I can't even lie. I have to give her her dues. Yeah.
Do you know what's jokes about therapy? Yeah. You'll be in a session, you'll be like, stop fucking reading me. Why are you reading me? And they're like, oh yeah, that's why I came.
Leave therapy vexed with a woman. Like,
like, people don't talk about the aftermath, because like, I'll go to therapy and I'll talk about something, and I've had quite of these like eureka moments in therapy when something just comes up from nowhere that I've really like suppressed. And then this woman is like, okay, cool, our 50 minutes is up.
No. Where are you going?
Honestly, there have been so many times I've just been outside the office, like, waiting for my Uber to come. And I'm like, hold on a minute.
So before we get into this even further, maybe we should tell everyone who you are. Aired all of your dirty laundry.
But wait, sorry, can you imagine, yeah? Can you imagine meeting someone for the first time and before they tell you their name, they're like, I had therapy today.
You what just happened a while ago?
Let's just get small talk.
You really went there. We were like, okay, let's get comfortable.
No, it works. But yeah, maybe we should let people know who we're speaking to. Raifa, do you want to like introduce yourself now that everyone knows how you feel about therapy?
Sure. My name is Raifa. I am a lawyer. I'm also a multi-award-winning podcaster. That's a mouthful. I'm also a writer. So yeah. I think that covers it all, really.
And you write a lot about your personal life, right? This is not, I mean, talking about your experiences is not something that's unfamiliar to you.
No, I mean, I'm a contributing author to a book called It's Not About the Burqa, where I talk about the complexities of being a Black Muslim woman. So that's been published for, I think, 2 years now. And yeah, I'm very on the podcast that I've previously had, Mostly Lit, my current podcast, This Thing Changed My Life. We get really personal. And I feel like if you listen to those, then you pretty much know 40% of who I am.
A good chunk.
Yeah.
So was religion something that was always kind of a main feature in your life? I mean, I gather you grew up in a very conservative background. Yeah. Is it something you rebelled against and then embraced later on? Like,
I feel like I'm still rebelling a little bit. But no, I grew up in a really strict, conservative Muslim home in East London. And because it was so strict, I think in the beginning, I really conflated. And I feel like my community also really conflated and merged together culture with religion. And there are certain things I really was like, I can't believe this is a part of something that I should believe in if I just think it's a bit silly. But obviously it's just like your parents being like, don't do this, or it's not just for me, but God said it, or, you know, you're not allowed to. And just to give their whatever they want a bit of weight. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I think, I definitely rebelled, but my rebellion wasn't wild. I still kind of like towed the lines a little bit, you know, until you reach university and...
Do you feel like because you are a journalist, because like you have that interest to like ask questions and to find out more and to like, you know, shine a light on things, that growing up in a strict religious household was like, did it have an impact? Because like you said, you asked questions and the answer was always like, oh, God knows all, like, don't question it. And do you feel like that pushed you even more in the direction you were going in?
Absolutely. I think I was that child that really never took what was told to them as gospel. It was always like, why this, why that? To the point where, you know, you'd have adults who no longer have an answer because obviously they've never questioned these beliefs that they were also taught. They're also dumbfounded and dumbstruck. They don't know how to respond. And the only thing was to then to tell you that, oh, you know, you're not respectful, you know, you're not, you know, you don't have a strong faith and belief. And so it just never sat well with me. But I think education really, really helped me, not just Western education, but even just like learning about my religion and taking time to just read what is in the script rather than being told by some uncle or some other, you know, older person in the community. And I think that has really allowed me to carve out my own parameters of my belief. So I'm definitely, you know, Muslim, but there are certain things that I'm like, I'm not going to adhere to this because, one, I definitely think that culture has really informed that decision. And that's why you think that's part of the religion. And it's really hard, actually, because it can be quite lonely, especially when you don't find people in the community who maybe think the way you do. And so you just really have to go out of your way to find young people or other individuals who also have that inquisitive mind who just also just want to inspect and criticize and critique what they've been told. But I think that goes across for everything, not just like religion, you know. I think it's just the way you choose to live your life, really.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because I feel like the same can be said for Christianity, right? I grew up in a very conservative Christian household, which is interesting because my dad was a Methodist but my mom's Hindu, and so she kind of almost erased her religion for the sake of my dad imposing this very like Christian conservative background, or you know, kind of lifestyle on us. But growing up, I think I found it increasingly difficult to adhere to certain aspects of Christianity which were presented in a really conservative way, because I felt like I was this progressive, you know, woman who didn't believe in certain things. And Shan, I don't know, because Shan also is a currently practicing Christian. I don't know if you struggle with that now, Shan, in terms of like reconciling things that you believe in from a faith perspective and then principles on your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I definitely think it's hard and there's challenges, but I think the way to kind of, or in my experience, the way to kind of navigate that best is to make sure that my journey is really personal to me and God. And I think once you do that, then you have your own decision of what's right and wrong for you, and you can feel content in that. If you have a parent or a friend saying, don't do this or do that, and then you do it and you're like, all these isms and schisms about whether or not you should have done it, it's because you was never sure about your decision, because it wasn't actually you wanting to do that or not wanting to do that. It was someone else's pressure and beliefs like kind of put on you. I feel like there's a stigma that Christians can't drink. And it's like, I've got to then take it upon myself to be like, who's told me this notion? Is this a real thing, or have I just been told this growing up? And then I will then do the research for myself to come up with my own understanding about what that means for me. When it comes to religion, it's very subjective. So I can read a text and you can read a text and we can get two different examples from it. But it's only down to, you have to only stick to what you believe. Otherwise, you're never going to feel like you're living life for yourself. And then you're going to end up being depressed because you're going to feel like you're never hitting this bar or standard that everybody around you wants you to have. I started there. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And I really agree. Because like,
facts, babe. Facts. Yeah,
when I moved out, and I moved out from home, and it was like a wild thing because like no Muslim girl in my community has really ever moved out from home. I was the bad girl that has just gone awry.
Bad girl.
it was bad. And so when I moved home, and already I was like, oh my God, doom and gloom. Like, God doesn't love me. You know, what is it inside me that doesn't want to adhere to these things that I've been told? And because I looked at those things as like truth, and I looked at other people's journey as what I should aspire to, and because I wasn't hitting that bar, it just made me feel that I was a complete failure in this thing, and that just like took me over the edge. I said, therapy, let's go, because I'm not well. But I definitely agree, like just living your own truth and your own journey is really important, because otherwise you're just going to really struggle.
Yeah. Do you find that you have to consistently defend your position, not only to your community, but to people who perceive you as a traditional Black Muslim woman as well?
That's a really good question. What I am like careful with is when I meet other Muslim women. So I mean, I cover, for instance, and I guess look really conservative, but I also have like a sailor's mouth, and I'm always swearing my eye, but I feel like I'm also very liberal. And so when I meet other Muslim women who will look at me and think, oh, like she's very conservative, and then I'll just start talking wreck, then they'll just be a bit pulled back. But I used to worry about it before, definitely when I was a little bit younger, 2-3 years ago, but nah, not in this 2021. No, not anymore. Cause yeah.
Well, it's funny because you, as you said, you kind of do present as a conservative woman, but on your IG, you're serving looks all day. I don't know if you guys have seen Raifa's Instagram, but.
No, share it with me so I can go and be nosy now.
You know what? Let me tell you something. All the madness happens on the close friends. So y'all are actually missing out.
Ooh. Damn. We had the close friends. We missing out.
You better add me.
But yeah, I think there is that like discrepancy. And I always tell my friend, like, I have a good friend of mine who's Muslim. And we always talk about the halal haram gap. It's that, okay, when we meet a fellow Muslim person, it's like, okay, let's sit down. Like, where are you at on that scale? And also it's a very much no judging Breakfast Club. You know, you are who you are.
But I think that's interesting because I think a lot of people, well, I'd assume that a lot of people in different religions can also relate. And I think, again, that sort of idea of like, how haram are you? Is that the phrase that you use? I think, again, that kind of comes from like, because you know that there's a stigma and there's a pressure for what it means to be a particular, like be of a particular faith or religion. Yeah. In the same way, like with a Christian, it's like, even on this podcast, yeah, I think there was an episode where I said that I was a Christian, and I said on the podcast that was the first time I'd ever said it out loud, because I know that people have so much judgment towards it. Because you might hear one episode of me talking about that, the one episode talking to me about how I like sucking dick. Do you know what I mean? I can't do all the judgment. You get what I mean? I mean, I've never actually said that before.
Power to you.
No, I've never actually said that on the podcast. I was using that as a figure of like an extreme, like opposing.
But it's true, honey. Like, but it's true.
But like in the sex episode, I'm very vocal and I'm very open about things that I've enjoyed and I've done before. And it's like in my head, I'm like, oh, I don't want people to judge me. And da-da-da-da. But that's why you've got to be really strong and secure in who you are. So it's like, actually, I'm happy. Go ahead and judge. It's okay. Talk about me in your group chats. I'm okay with it. Because this is me. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so important.
Yeah, at university, there was a girl who I was friends with. And she became like really uncomfortable with, I guess, just how liberal I was. And we started off as really good friends. And then she just kind of like, you know, stop talking to me. And I was just like, but why? Like, I just, till this day, it was like, oh, okay. I think she just wasn't comfortable with, and I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'm so cool with that. But also I'm never going to like change myself to please you and make you feel better and make you feel more comfortable. Like, you have to get with the train, like the program, or bye.
Get with the train, get with the program, get with the schedule,
get
with it all, honey. Yeah, honestly, at this big, big age, to have friends or even like acquaintances, like whatever it might be, that, you know, don't get you or have questions that, you know, Google is there for, like, it's just so long. It's very, very long.
So actually, just on that note, in terms of, because you talked a little bit about mixing culture or the mixing of culture and religion. And I'm kind of wondering, what are some of like the common misperceptions that you often have to deal with, that as a Black Muslim woman, as opposed to a South Asian Muslim woman, like, are there distinctions to be made, or you know, do you feel a distinction between the two experiences as you understand it, particularly because there is this compounding of race that adds to your experience?
I think the line that it toes is definitely race, only because I wrote this in like my essay, especially like the South Asian community. When I came to England, it almost felt like they had taken custody of Islam, especially the South Asian community and the Arabs. So you're coming in as a Black woman, born Muslim from a Muslim community that is also Black. And all of a sudden, these different communities who in the UK or in the West are like the face of Islam, all of a sudden they don't accept you. And or they, you know, they'll ask if you're a Reva and you're like, bro, no. And so
what is that? Educate me.
So Muslims believe that every person, every child is born a Muslim. Right. And so when you convert to Islam, you're actually reverting. Because you were already born Muslim. So yeah, we call it revert. Yeah. But yeah, it's just, I would say it's just the race line that predominantly separates me anyway from other Muslim people. And so I always get, oh man, like the ecstasy I get when I meet other like Black Muslim women is, I'm like, yo, hello, sis. So yeah, no, it's definitely, I've actually gone a lot of my life not thinking that there wasn't a lot of us. So I remember when I found like one of my best friends is a Black Muslim woman and she's Nigerian. I was like, yo, I was like, this is amazing. Take me to Lagos now.
Because actually there is quite a large Black Muslim population, right? I mean, massive one. So it's interesting that you felt that feeling of isolation.
I was gonna ask you about that, because I think definitely from my experience of just meeting and connecting with Black people, I can probably count one person, I think, that who I know that was a Black Muslim woman.
Really?
Yeah, I don't, and it wasn't even my friend.
Maybe
it's the one that I knew.
Because not growing up, but during my time in New York, I met quite a lot of Black Muslim men, but definitely a good number of Black Muslim women as well.
There's quite a lot in New York, I'm sorry, in the States, and quite a few of them actually are Nation of Islam as well. So there's like a difference in that as well. But there is actually a lot. But, you know, in East London, where I was growing up, there definitely wasn't. It's just a big Asian Muslim community.
Did you say Nation of Islam?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What does that mean?
So that's
like, but I know what that means.
Malcolm X was Nation of Islam. So Malcolm X was Nation of Islam. And they just believe in a different version, so it's definitely like Catholicism and like Protestants or just different.
Oh, is that a denomination?
Yes, but
oh, okay,
very, very different. So yeah,
I guess you refer to it as much more militant and literal in many senses, right?
I'm not sure, but I do know that like it's so weird because their Islam really much goes against like the pillar of the other Islams. I don't know if that even makes sense. So yeah, it's very, very different. And a lot of like Black African Americans are like Nation of Islam, but also they're also just Muslims as well, which is why I need to go to America. I don't know what I'm doing here. Okay. I need to go find my husband. Oh, sorry.
He's out there waiting. He's just in the Nation of Islam somewhere.
Here, like you just be falling in love with somebody, and then it's like, all right, bro. So, are you gonna revert? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah. What's the dating scenario like? When are you open to dating people outside of your religion? How does that work?
Oh, sis, it is hard out here. I can't even lie. To be honest, it's been a point of like contentious vibe, like a lot of like intimate relationships I've had. Funnily enough, I've actually never dated a Muslim man. Oh no, I have. I have. Yes, I have, but I just wasn't feeling the dude. So it's so mad. It's like, even if you do meet one out of, you finally meet that one, and then they just don't turn out to be as, you know, fly as you'd want them to be. So yeah, it's hard.
What's more important for you when it comes to dating? Is it a man being Black or a man being Muslim?
Oh, I can't. There was, to be honest.
You can. Tell me.
Do you know what it is, yeah? I can't lie. Like, as much as they are just the, ugh, yeah. That's my kryptonite. Like, you give me a fine Black man.
Amen. Amen.
Can we all just snap to that? Yes. Yes.
Fine Black man who is self-aware, like who just has
chocolate. A unicorn.
Chocolate.
Actually, Shani, the same question for you applies. Would you prefer to date somebody? What's more important to you?
Let me tell you. Dating Black. They're both. I think, yeah, it's jokes, because when I said it to Raifa, I was like, no, you have to choose. But now the question's been put to me. I think they genuinely both are as equally important. However, black. The first example that came to my head that made me say black when you said it, on Christmas this year, it was just me and my boyfriend, yeah? And I didn't have to lift a finger. I didn't have to cook. Fuck all. And do you know what? The food tasted flavor. Now, I cannot if I'm with someone of a different ethnicity that I'm going to have that experience of flavor and seasoning without my input.
I don't cook either. I mean, me and domestic labor, I'm trying to radicalize my life. Like I can cook, but I just don't want to because we have suffered too much. So
this is me. Can you just high five me on the screen, please? High five me.
I my partner cooks like all the time. Me? Nah, I'll just be there watching girlfriends. Like, hey boo.
This is me. Oh my god. If I show you my Snapchat from Christmas, yeah, all I did was make cocktails, not even for him, just for me.
Nah, you were living your best life.
Shan, stop it. You know what's funny is that I met a guy this past couple of months. I've been saying to myself, oh, I'm going to expand my parameters around dating. And yeah, if he's not like typically my type, I'm still going to go out there. And I was on holiday for New Year's Eve with my girlfriends and a really cool guy. I saw this guy out at the corner and he looked kind of tan. And then I was like, okay, so maybe he's like mixed or something like that. And then I found out he was from New York and he's like, yeah, I'm Italian. And I was like, oh, okay, well.
That's nice.
I don't know. But like just the concept of me dating outside of my race or dating a white man is just, I don't know if it's something that I can get down with.
I know this is but so silly, yeah, but in my head, Italians aren't white. I know it's dumb. I remember arguing with someone about it before. I think, Liz, wasn't you there in the office? Like, and,
I don't know.
But in my head, they're not white. They don't make fish and chips.
If you're like a white man and I date you, you'd have to look like...
That's so annoying.
You'd have to go down. Like, you'd have to literally...
But also, at the time, I would also just be thinking, like, are you fetishizing me? Because
this is it. Am I dating my colonizer? I don't know.
Like... Stop it! Did I get my last name from you?
But in that example, yeah, you saw him. You found him attractive. You even weren't convinced he was white, and then you found out. So, like, surely maybe you're gonna give him a chance.
I can find white men attractive, but when I drill down to it, is it something that I really, you know, like, I don't know. Like, I think about the fact that I want to have black kids, and I think about the fact that I want culturally certain things to be at play. And yeah, it's just, I don't know if it's, I guess it's very similar to the concept of trying to decide whether you want to date outside your religion and how important it is to you. It's like a spectrum, right? I don't know. Livs, what do you think?
Could you date a man that wasn't Jamaican, Leanne?
I have. No, I have. But they have to be very culturally aware. Like the last guy that I dated that was Ghanaian, actually, our first date, quoted Vibes Cartel to me, and I was like, yeah, so
love. Can we get him back? Can we get him back? Listen, Raifa, there's no bigger stan than Leanne when it comes to Vibes Cartel.
Today's his birthday, by the way. Big up, Cartel.
I'm gonna swing.
She said, big up the man in the jailhouse.
I actually like dating is, in our current world, very political. And because I used to be very much like, you know what, love who you love. You know, love is love. Everything is, you know, like open. That is how we break down the walls. And just doing a lot more reading and a lot more research, like it's especially because we live in a world where like there is no level playing field, and the politics and the outside world really does affect your domestic life. And I kind of like really tapped into that, and I wouldn't feel, oh, a part of me would be like, yo, I'm letting something down.
Yeah, same.
If I didn't get with a black man.
Thing is, I hear that. And like, I'm, for the record, I am with a black man. That's my baby. But
Shout out Josh.
Shout out my man. But I do get what you're saying about how, you know, being a black woman and dating is usually political in some way or another. And sometimes I'm tired of like the Black Love stuff. Like, don't, you know, I hope I don't get shot or cancelled for this, but like, it's like, let us just be rather than it being a thing. Do you know what I mean? It's a hard thing to balance, but sometimes I see these adverts and I feel like it's hella cheesy. Like, it's like, oh, Black Love is like better than any other love. It's very like...
But I guess it's, again, it's like...
Liv, can I just say, Liv, you're very lucky you did that like, disclaimer. They were going to come for your neck.
Yes, I was going to say it all.
It's like, Black love can only be, like, better than any other love, like, if it's healthy. If
yeah,
it's,
yeah. Like, for the sake of Black love.
Exactly, because Black love can be trash, okay?
That's toxic!
Toxic as hell, right? You have oppression outside, and now I'm oppressed inside my own house by my own man, no.
Well, it's the oppressed oppressor syndrome, right? Like Black men who are consistently oppressed by the status quo and institutionalized racism, yeah, oftentimes take their like aggression or their trauma out on the closest thing to them, and that is the Black woman. And in the same vein, I work with Black women victim survivors all the time, and they will actively say, sometimes I'm so angry and so frustrated, I take it out on the first person that's in my space, which is their children. Mm. And so that cycle of trauma sometimes can be very toxic and very, you know, impactful and traumatic for the people around us. So I definitely get what Livs is saying and what you're saying, Raifa, as well. But I don't know, there's something about that Black man.
Mm.
Guys,
no, I'm joking.
Transitioning out of our
Black men obsession.
You talk about a lot about microaggressions in the workplace, and obviously, I assume you probably work in a white-dominated space. Is yeah. that right?
Yeah. So, I'm a lawyer, and in my old firm. Oof.
What kind of do you practice, actually, just out of curiosity?
Hedge funds.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm a hedge funds lawyer. And I was actually talking about this today with one of my friends. It's just, you know, I think so many of us go through microaggressions and we just have to find ways to navigate it. But I'm even at a point where I'm like, I might need a bit of help because this shit is overwhelming. Especially now that, like, obviously so many of us are working from home, how can you become visible? So it's even more like, it's even worse because you're now even more invisible because they can't even see you. And are you going to get the work that you should be getting, etc.? But yeah, I think tackling microaggressions, even if it's just like bringing in more Black people in the workplace, a lot of people talk about that and just getting more people in. As much as that helps, higher up the pipeline, there's nobody. Mm-hmm. And when you're thinking about managing work, the culture at the top determines the culture at the bottom. And so if there isn't Black people up the ladder, Black people with power, not just like that one person that is there to fill the quota, how can you get rid of that culture? So it is very difficult, especially for like so many young millennial working professionals in like the city or elsewhere. I don't know how it is in the creative space, because I don't work in the creative space. And I do, but like for myself, not in like a creative organization. Mm. So I don't know. Do any of you work in the creative space? Is it much different?
Livs and Shan both work in the creative industry.
Yeah, I would say it's a similar thing for sure, where a lot of companies will hire Black people at a low level because, yeah, like, you know, we bring like culture and we bring creativity and like we bring those diversity numbers. Like, but, you know, as you said, like when you go higher up the food chain, you know, you'll be surprised how many companies, despite the fact that they use like Slay or whatever, or like Fleek on their campaign, you know, you'll be surprised the higher you got the food chain, they're all white, they're all men, they're all middle class, and it's just, yeah, not, yeah, it's definitely a problem for sure. you know, you, as we spoke about at the top of this episode, you are one of the co-hosts of Mostly Lit, which is hugely successful podcast. It's doing really well. And yeah, I wanted to ask how that came together and why. Like, let's talk about diversity in literature for a bit, where your love for that comes from.
Oh, I mean, I've always loved reading. I think for me, reading, I always say like reading makes people think better. It makes people think more critically. It gives people an insight into other people's world and lives. Reading builds compassion. It builds connection between different people from all walks of life. And so if you can have that tool, like, why would you not want to utilize it? I also think it makes you smarter. and so I've always loved reading, mainly because I've just always loved storytelling. And as much as I like call myself a writer, I just more so would say I'm a storyteller. I remember when I was younger, my first memories was of my grandmother telling me like stories and fairy tales, but in like the oral form back home in Zanzibar. And so I've always had that like love for literature and storytelling. When I came to England, I didn't know any English. And I remember I was given this book to read, and it was very, very hard and difficult. And I remember the first day where I managed to like finish it and move on to like the next tier. And till this day, that remains like one of like my biggest achievements. It's like my favorite memory ever. You know, just
honestly, I felt triggered when you said tier. I was like, no, I'm not talking about tears.
I'm sorry.
So triggered.
Yeah, and so that's really important to me. But in terms of like representation, I actually didn't see myself represented in a book until like, I think I was maybe just starting sixth form, and I read a book that had a Muslim girl in it. She wasn't even black, she was just a Muslim girl. And it really changed my life, because I finally felt like, oh, like this issue that I had, somebody else had it. And obviously, like now I'm older, it's like not that big a deal, but at that age, it meant everything to me. And then just seeing, there was another book that I read when I was pretty, when did I read this? Oh, I think I read this at university. It talks about the diaspora young black woman. So it's called Nervous Conditions by Titsi Dangarembga. And it talks about a young girl who grew up in London, and she moved back to the continent, and just her struggle with not fitting in there and coming back and also not fitting in here. And I kind of had that issue and I still like trying to navigate it, because I go back home at least once a year. And when I go there, it's like, as much as you speak Swahili, you're not really one of us, Raifa. And I'm like, but I'm are you guys okay? You know, and when I come here, it's like, oh, but like I miss that Zanzibari part of me. So that book like drastically changed my world, because again, it was that connection that I felt, knowing that you're not alone, building connections with people. And so genuinely, I met one of the co-hosts of Mostly Lit called Alex via like a dinner that one of our like mutual friends just like posted on Twitter. This was like 2015. One of our mutual friends who we didn't really know each other, he was like, oh, like I'd love to like have dinner with these people from the timeline. And he made a group, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll come. And I met Alex there, and we just got to know each other. And then one day we made a joke about, I think it was like Shakespeare online. He entered my DMs and he was like, oh, like, do you want to like start a podcast? Didn't know what a podcast was. This was 2015. I was like, what's a podcast? And he was like, oh, you know, it's like radio, but like not live, it's like audio. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I actually didn't think it would happen, because, you know, I know black people, they'll just always be saying, let's do something. And then, yeah. And like 2 days later, he was like, oh, like, do you want to meet up with this like company? You know, they like would love the idea. And we started talking about the name and stuff, and genuinely that's how it came about. It was so, and I love it, because obviously like this was like the beginning of podcasts weren't really a thing. It was really like earlier on, it was much bigger in the States at this time, and so it was just so new. And like I love that. My favorite artistic space and environment is that like rugged place where you haven't made it, but you have this exciting content that you want to make and you're like underground. And that for me is like the perfect artistic place of like expression and content creation, because you're really just doing it for the heart and the love for it.
And you're uninhibited as well. It's like you can do
anything. Like when I started my new podcast, I had all of these worries because obviously I know the game. I know how it's like. I'm not thinking, I just want to create something great. I'm like, oh God, like, I hope the audio content is great. You know, like, I hope, you know, I can work with these people. I hope I can get this guest. But in the beginning of Most Elite, it was very much like, let's talk about this book. We love this book. Let's talk about it. And so that's just how it started. It went on for like, we stopped recording, I think, last year.
That's a long time. It's like 5 years.
Yeah, four years. Was it last? I think it was maybe like the year before last, end of, I think, 2018. But yeah, maybe we'll come back. Who knows? It might not be in
the Alex, podcast. Actually, I love his book recommendations on his Instagram as well. Yeah. What's your favorite book, or do you have like key recommendations that everybody, like books, five books that everybody has to read?
Five books that everybody has to read. Okay, I'm literally looking at my bookshelf. First book, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. It is, I read it last year, I think. And this book, I don't even have words. It's a bit thick, but it is the book that I think I have never cried as much. And also, if you're going to read it, you need a support system, because Alex is the one that recommended it to me, my fellow podcaster. And he was like, you need to read this book. And I was like, but he was like, you need to be in the good mental state to read this book, because it's really triggering. But it, as much as it's very painful, it really shows love in a way that is so naked and open. And it also, it doesn't really focus on romance. It's very much about friendship and the bonds that you have with your friends and how strong those bonds can be. But it can be a little bit traumatic because it has things like self-harm, it has things like suicide and like sexual trauma and abuse. But I also tell people there's also like friendship and love and family. And Hanya is really great at creating a world. So when you're reading this book, you're really like entering a whole world. So yeah, I would say A Little Life. Next book I would say is The Eyes We're Watching God.
Oh, such a good book.
Like,
Laura is one of my favorite writers of all time.
She's amazing. I remember reading that book, and at the end of it, I was just tingling. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I would also say Nervous Conditions. So I mentioned that by Titsi Dangaremga. That's three. You know what? I really liked Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. I think for a Black British woman, that book is phenomenal, especially reading it now. It's very like timely. So definitely read that. And I was like, this is a beautiful piece of work. And gosh, she can write. Okay, last one. Okay, I've got it. I also read this quite recently. An American Marriage. What's her name again? The book is called An American Marriage. That book is like drama. Like, it's drama. It's just so much drama, but also really well written, and just beautiful as well. And it really just talks about how, it's about how like being an incarcerated Black man who's been in prison, how that can like affect your domestic life, how it can affect your relationship with your wife, and family. And just the impact of structural racism on the domestic home. So I would say that. I think that's five.
What is your advice for, you know, how to just like get started reading, how to just get into it? People that like may or may not be talking about myself right now, but just find it hard just to even like start that first page. Like, I know it sounds stupid, but like I've become so consumed by screens that like to sit down and read a book, it actually can be quite difficult, but it's something I definitely want to get into in lockdown.
Olivia, so like, this is honestly, okay. you're not the only person because this was my struggle. Like last year, I put on my to-do list to read 6 books for the year. I thought 6 is small. I have How not completed the book. I didn't complete it. I think it's the same book I had from the book the year before. Like, I don't know what, I can start them, but I can't complete them. Do you get it?
Oh, and I stop and then I never go back.
Yeah, and part of me is like, I can't start another book until I finish the last one.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly fighting myself. Then I'm like, but I haven't got a book.
But then I wasn't even where was I? Clearly, like.
So when you're answering this question, Raifa, it's not just for me and Liv. I'm sure there's more people that need to know.
To be honest, I'm like also reading myself to filth because, I mean, last year was a really, really tough year. And so I actually didn't manage to read a lot of books. I dealt with like a lot of like grief last year, people passing away, just COVID. And I was also like talking to myself and being like, oh my God, like, I'm such a loser. How can I have not read the amount of books that I set out for myself? But I also just like compassion, you know, I actually do compassion therapy and just being like calm with yourself, because if you make it in your head like this is something that you have to do, you're just not going to do it. And if you put a lot of guilt towards that connection with reading, that you're just not going to do it because you're not going into it like, oh, I'm really interested. You're going into it like, I have to finish this book. And it's just, for me, it's the same with like how I look at like the gym, for instance. Like if I'm like, I need to exercise because I'm going to get fat, then I'm just not really going to do it because I've already associated it with something negative. And so what I try to do, like today, actually, was the first day I picked up a book in the new year. And I would say a page a day, like make it so small, even if it's like half a page, like lower your expectations. And then just find the energy to do it. Because if I say I'm going to read half the book today, I'm not even going to pick it up because just that expectancy is just so much. But literally
half a book in a day.
I can't even do that in a month.
What kind of brain power? Your eyes are like,
you know what? I sent this list of books to Shan maybe like a few weeks ago. No, it was months ago, right? It was late last year.
Yeah.
And there are these like Penguin books that are literally this thin.
Oh yeah, I've got them. Yeah.
Like with Martin Luther King Jr. There's one by Vladimir Nabokov. There's Chinua Achebe. There's loads of like epic writers who have written, they've gotten selected kind of excerpts from their speeches or just random pieces that they wrote. And those are so small and they're so interesting that it feels more manageable because they're shorter, but they're still really informative books that will.
You're making me feel guilty.
No, I'm
not.
I'm going to go back to that list. No, because I actually asked Leanne, like, I actually came to Leanne as a friend in need. And I was like, Leanne, I want to learn more about, what did I say, like Black history or something?
Yeah, I think you wanted more of the historical context for some of the things that we talk about now.
Yeah, and then I was like, can I have a list of some books, please? I started the message in all fairness, so I need to order it.
Yeah.
But like, oh yeah, don't associate guilt with it.
Yeah.
Like, it makes it so hard. Like, this morning, I sat down with my coffee and I went, ooh, I looked at my shelf and I said, oh, which one do I want to read today? And I tried to make it so fun for myself. And the first like page was like a little bit difficult because like my brain just wasn't really settled. And then like you just get into that flow. And it's like running, like I've taken up running. I know, I don't even know who I am anymore. But like the thought of running like 6 months ago, disgusting, like I'm not a runner. And I started doing like this program of like just running for like 1 minute and then stopping. I managed to do 5K, like I can run 5K now. Which is crazy. Like, I'm like, how? I don't even know. But
Goals.
But once you get in the flow of running, I just forget it. Like when I'm running, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm even forgetting that I'm like doing something.
Oh, wow.
And I had this moment when I was reading this morning where I was so interested in something that just time went and I was just reading. And that is the sweet spot. When you hit that.
Yeah.
Do you think there's the best time to start? Like to both Leanne and Raifa. Sorry, not you, Livs, because you're like me. But is it better to like, feel like when I was younger as a child, I was like a bookworm. Like my mum could not take me away from reading. Like, but I used to always read before I went to bed.
Mm.
So like that was my routine. So like for you guys, do you have a set time where you think you focus better or that you're able to keep up a routine when it comes to reading?
I can't read before bed because I'm the type of person that if I hit my bed, I'm sleeping. There is no way. I've tried that and genuinely doesn't work for me. I prefer reading the first thing in the morning because, like, I'm just in my bed. Normally, like, I'd be on my phone. So I'm like, oh, let me have my book.
That's a good idea.
I'm in bed and I'm up and I'm awake. And instead of, like, going on my phone, I'm like, let me just read a page. Literally, I tell myself, let me read a page. And before you know it, I've read, like, 5 pages.
Do you know what's funny? I used to read, when I was in England, I used to read on the train. And actually, the commute was such a good time to read because you want to, like, zone out all of the shit that's going on around you. And you can get, as you said, Raifa, you can get lost. But now that I'm here and I drive everywhere, before bed is actually probably the only time I get to read now. But I keep falling asleep. So actually one of the tricks that I've tried to use is I'm now rereading one of my favorite books. So my favorite book that I read last year is this book called Heavy by Kiese Lehmann. If you guys haven't read it, I would suggest reading. It's amazing. But yeah, so I'm going to try. So that's been good because it's something I already know that I love. And so I look forward to reading the story and getting a different perspective on it. But I'm going to try reading in the morning, actually, because I do keep falling asleep.
Yeah, I used to read on the commute. That was literally when I would read. When I was at uni, because I studied English literature, I hated like being in the library too much. So what I would do is I was on like the Victoria line and I would start from like Walthamstow Central, go down all the way to Brixton and then get on a train back and I'll just read.
Mm.
That was how I got through the books.
Yeah, the commute is probably the best way.
Yeah, we don't have that anymore.
Oh yeah.
We're just stuck inside. So that's why it's pretty difficult. But yeah, no, like cut yourself some slack. Like, you don't, I even asked yesterday on Twitter, like just asked like, oh, you know, what's like everybody's reading goals this year? And people were like 200 books, 150, what? 100. And then other people were like, oh, I was only planning to
books.
Yeah. Who's trying to read 100 books in a year?
That's my goal this year.
Oh, 100 books.
I'm out here like 100 pages if I can.
Excuse me?
I'm saying 100, but I'll probably only be able to do like 60.
No, stop. Let's focus on the 60. Excuse me?
But my thing is it has to be like a habit, like a daily habit.
Yeah.
Like a daily thing. If I skip a day or skip 2 days, chances are I'm going to stop reading. Just like for me, like the gym. If I don't go for a week, that's 3 months. I'm not hitting it.
Mate, I stopped going for a week. Then it hit 2 weeks. Then the whole of 2020 might as well have been a write-off. I put on so much weight. Let me tell you how much weight I put on. I put on so much weight that my boyfriend bought me an Apple Watch for Christmas because of the fitness setting. And then he said, I'll give you £300 if you lose X amount of weight in 4 weeks. This is a crisis, okay?
I've gained, I was like 62 or 63, and like I'm literally like just under like 70, and I asked for an Apple Watch for the holidays and I got it, and completing these rings is hard.
No, it's a myth. It was like day 2 of having the watch. He's like, have you completed the ring? So can you chill out? I'm still eating my Christmas dinner.
My worst is when it tells you to stand up. They'll be like, stand up for a minute. And I'm like, yo.
What?
Yeah, like, so there's like a ring. It'll tell you, it kind of goes workout, movement, and like standing. So if you're standing for too long, the watch will buzz for you to stand up. So I'll just be randomly talking to somebody and I'll just be like, oh, sorry, guys, I have to stand up. The watch is...
Are you mad? I will scream with the watch. I'll be like, who are you telling to stand up? Like, I'm in bed. Why are you trying to bad me time? Like, we ain't standing up, honey.
For anyone who's young and might be listening or supporting someone who is Black and Muslim and they have challenges with understanding their identity?
I would say break all the rules and then get to know yourself. So, I mean, break all the rules that you think you can break and maybe you want to break, and then get to know yourself from there. So, I mean, that's how I've dealt with it. It's very much like, there was a lot of things that I didn't understand. So I said, all right, let's destroy it all. And then start from the beginning. Start building your blocks of your own values and your own beliefs and understanding. Boundaries, like have boundaries with your friends, have boundaries with your parents. And that is like very, very difficult. But those people need to know what's up.
Mm.
So yeah, I would say... I would say break all the rules
don't listen to men. And enjoy yourself. Like, I'm literally the advocate and the minister of enjoyment, because I feel like that's what I should be doing with my life.
Amen.
Genuinely, like, find joy in, like, wake up every day and have, like, moments of joy, because especially in the times that we're living in, there's just so much, you know, heartache and sadness that sometimes you're just questioning, like, what am I doing? So make your joy very conscious and very, like, specific, I would say.
So thanks so much for listening, guys. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. On Facebook and Twitter, we are Dope Black Woman, and on Instagram, we're Dope Black Woman 1. So we will be back with you next week. Until then, stay blessed and unapologetically black.
All the way black.
Blackly black.
Blacktastic. Hey!